formally welcome everyone to the second semester. And before I start, I just want to mention that I want to dedicate tonight's shiur to the memory of my father. Tonight is his seventh yard site. His name is Mas'ud Ben Chai. And also want to encourage people, I brought some liqueur and some extra cakes in the back, so please to make a bracha or two brachot, if possible, le'ilui nishmato. The topic I want to speak about today, we've been speaking about historical development of halakha and to a lesser extent Jewish thought, Jewish theology in response to historical development. The topic I want to deal with today is related, it's still talking about the impact of historical development on Yahadut, but here I want to tackle a topic which is often ignored, people are often unaware of, and that's the issue of the historical development of language and how that impacts on Judaism. And I'm going to focus on one particular example, but I think this is true, that has many ramifications and it expresses itself in many different ways. The example that I'm going to speak about today is the issue of the mashal, the metaphor, and how that has helped us historically deal with spiritual realities that are very difficult to comprehend, and as a result have been successful, meaning the metaphorical language has been successful in allowing Jews to be religiously motivated in wanting to do what they see in their self-interest. Now, I'll explain what I mean in a couple minutes, but I just want to give you a general examples of what I mean by development of language. Whether we thought about it or not, words change their meanings. Anybody who's looked in a dictionary, sometimes we see words that are defined as Old English, Middle English, and you know, Rashi speaks in Old French, which to anyone who knows French is almost a different language, very very difficult to decipher. This past Shabbat, those of you who were with us, we discussed a word that appears in the Tanakh, which in modern Hebrew is different, and I don't know if it's postmodern Hebrew, but in our own times has come to acquire different meanings as well. I spoke about the word zikaron. Zikaron in modern Hebrew, what does zikaron mean? In
memory.
Memory, okay. And the newer application is not only do humans have zikaron, but also computers have zikaron, which if you think about it is really not exactly the same concept, even though there's an obvious similarity. And we spoke over Shabbat that zikaron in Tanakh, certainly in Chumash, but I would say also in Nevim Ketuvim, means something different. It does not mean memory. If you look through, the only way that you can authentically come to define a word in Tanakh is looking how it's used in varieties of contexts and what these contexts have in common. If you look through that, at least the conclusions that I came up with, I invite you to perform the exercise as well, is that zikaron means memory device. It's not memory, but it's a memory device. For example, we spoke about Pesach being a day that's supposed to be a memory device of what happened in Mitzrayim. It's called a zikaron. The ephod is called a zikaron, supposed to remind God of the Jewish people. And it's not a memory, it's a memory device. It's what makes him think about the Jewish people. That's one example. In Biblical Hebrew, that we have to realize when we see the word zikaron, automatically we're going to think of how it's used today. But in fact, that's artificial and incorrect, and we would have a misconception of what zikaron means in the Tanakh, and vice versa. The other word also appears in Biblical Hebrew, but the context I want to give the example of is in Mishnaic Hebrew. It's a famous statement of Chazal that people like to joke around about when they have friends who are doctors. The Talmud tells us, Tov Shibirofe le Gehenom. Right? The best doctor goes to Gehenom. Right? So, ostensibly, that's a very strong statement and a rather difficult statement. And one could philosophize about what that means and the pressures on a doctor and why they might not lead such an ethical life, or why they may not take the responsibility seriously, etc., etc. But I think something that needs to be brought to bear is that a rufe of the Mishnah and the Gemara is not the same thing as a rufe is today. They're two very different practices. In other words, the idea is the same idea. They want to cure people. But so do African witch doctors, right? In other words, there is a large group, and you can call all of them Rufim, but when the Talmud's referring to Rufe, they're referring to a subset. Presumably, they didn't mean to refer to all people who would ever try to cure people. Presumably. I mean, and even if I'm wrong in my application, it still should be brought to bear that a Rufe today is not the same profession as a Rufe was in the time of the Talmud. Again, since the word is the same, it's very easy to fall into the trap and just simply say, Rufe is a Rufe. All you have to do is think about it and realize that that's incorrect. In the same way, Zikaron is not Zikaron. It's the same word, but in fact there's two different meanings. One an ancient meaning, one a modern meaning. I said I would focus, however, on the concept of metaphor and how it allows us to develop ourselves spiritually, to relate to spiritual realities that are difficult for us to understand. Before I do that, I want to preface my words with another thought. And that is the concept that Judaism is well aware of. I think that many philosophies are aware of, that people are motivated by and large by self-interest. That most people are motivated most of the time by what they think is good for them. You can translate that into Yetzer Hara if you want to, or if you want to translate it perhaps in a more generous fashion, you could call it Milo Lishma, a question of Lo Lishma, Ba Lishma, but ultimately Lo Lishma means that it's rooted in self-interest, which you could define as Yetzer Hara. And if you look in the literature in Brachot and Sota, the Yetzer Hara is not such a bad guy. And so there's a lot of good to be said for the Yetzer Hara. Be that as it may, there's a recognition in Jewish tradition that people are motivated, most people are motivated most of the time by selfish interest. And as a result, the concept of Olam Haba, of a spiritual reward after one dies, that is understood as something vastly superior than anything one could receive in this world, beyond the obvious property that it's eternal, that sort of idea is, obviously we believe it's a true idea, but it's certainly something that creates a motivatory scheme and motivates people to do mitzvot. That if you do mitzvot, so you get Olam Haba. The problem is trying to understand, well, what does that mean? As we have this spiritual reality, and it's not anything like that which we know in our mundane, regular lives. So how does a Jew get motivated? Granted, in words, you know, you can tell it's the best, it's the most wonderful thing, but if a person can't relate to it, you know, you can say how wonderful and how great it is, it's meaningless on some level. Today, in our times, understanding this concept, I think, has become even more difficult than in the past. Understanding the concept of Olam Haba, we think in much more tangible terms, in much more empirical terms and scientific terms, as a result of which it becomes very difficult to imagine anything that's divorced of the physical. That's not to say that it was easy in the past, but one way to bridge between the difficult spiritual concepts that are intangible no matter who you are, no matter what time you live, and very physical man who's used to his physical world is through the tools of language. And specifically, one of the tools that's been used most successfully by the Jewish people and by our masters through the Talmud is what's called the Mashal, right? Mashal, I don't need to explain because it's part and parcel of our tradition. We see it all the time throughout the Gemara. We're constantly hearing about this Mashal and that Mashal, the king that did this, and the queen that did that, and so on and so forth. We're constantly hearing about these things, which are meant to clarify spiritual concepts, among other things. Now, what I want to posit today is that a lot of these metaphors, the mashalim that have been used, especially those that help us define the most central concepts in Judaism, such as Olam Haba, such as HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, have broken down because language has changed and concepts have changed, and it's as if no one has noticed that the concepts that form the basis of the Mashal have broken down, and therefore there's a greater communication gap between the reality that they're supposed to be describing and the person they're being described to, or rather the generation that is meant to understand the Mashal. Just to illustrate, and I don't know if anybody feels brokenhearted by the introduction that I've just given, but if you listen carefully, and I chose my words carefully, I said brokenhearted because brokenhearted itself is a metaphor. As a metaphor, no matter how depressing you might have found the introduction, hopefully it wasn't that depressing, but even if you found it depressing, and one could describe your state as brokenhearted, clearly no one's going to die on the spot as a result of their heart splitting apart and breaking into pieces. The idea of the Mashal, the metaphor brokenhearted, is to help us understand the mood, right, which is ultimately an intangible idea, right, in a way that is more real, more physical, something that we can grasp onto. And as I said before, Jews have been using mashalim like these all the time, and it's something that's educational value is undebatable. Just to give you another example from the world of education, something again that we take for granted. The role of graduated education linguistically is to try to be able to grasp difficult concepts by way of simpler concepts. I'll give you an example of that. Right, in mathematics, I don't know how it's taught in Israel, though my children often show me their books, but I haven't looked too carefully. But I remember when I was learning, when I was in early childhood, that the way we were introduced to mathematics, and I assume this is universal, is we weren't told, well, here's, 1 plus 1, they equal 2, memorize it. But rather, here's one triangle and another triangle. How many triangles do you have? Because a triangle is something that's physical. In other words, there's an abstract concept. The number 1 is ultimately an abstract concept. It doesn't exist on a physical plane. But one triangle does exist. Right? So by way of the metaphor of the Mashal, that here you have two triangles that represent the number, the abstract 2, you understand what 2 is. 2 is a multiplicity. 2 is more than 1, less than 3, objects, or what have you. And this is what we do in the religious world as well. And as I said, we've done it very successfully throughout our history. It's interesting that Onkelos, I think this is last week's parsha, God tells Moshe that Aaron is going to be his Navi. Right? He's going to be his Navi. One wonders, well, what is that about? How can you be a Navi to a person? So the Targum Onkelos explains that's a Miturgaman. A Miturgaman is what? It's a translator, right? So one wonders still, because presumably Moshe speaks the same languages that Aaron does. Why is there a need for Aaron to be a Mitur Gaman. And if it was an issue of his spokesman, and perhaps this is what Targum means, then I would understand. But the Mitargem, at least in traditional usage, was someone who would take the drasha that was spoken by the Rav in Hebrew and would translate it into Aramaic. Besides, hopefully being a better speaker than the Rav, he was also someone who spoke the language better than the Rav. That doesn't seem to fit in to context with Moshe and Aaron. What I would suggest is that Aaron was able to bring down the lofty spiritual concepts into the terms of the common man. In other words, translation is not only going from one language to another. Right? If you abstract the idea of translation, it's taking information, it's taking words that are ununderstandable and making them into words that are understandable. The language per se is not really the issue. So what's happened today? Why is it that the metaphors that we've had in the past don't work for us? So give you an example. I mean, I could speak about brokenhearted, but let's go into the Kodesh directly, into one of the most common metaphors that we use for God. Again, God is like Olam HaZeh, a spiritual reality that's very complex and very difficult to understand. So experience is one thing, but to understand is another. So how does one relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So one way, I mentioned before all the mashalim about kings, right? So we often speak about God as a king. In the context of Yamim Noraim, we call him Avinu Malkeinu, right? So there's this contrast of two metaphors juxtaposed, right? The one metaphor is that of our father that you have a relationship with, and it's not just a father, it's specifically your father. And the other metaphor is specifically your king. Now, there are a variety of problems with this metaphor. The first one is what we mentioned before, is the question of whether the word king is the same word or has the same meaning as it did when it was coined. As when Chazal spoke about Malkeinu, Melech, they certainly didn't have the Queen of England in mind, right? They weren't speaking about this benevolent showcase person with a funny crown on their head, right? Again, something that when you think about may be obvious, but how many of us think about what we mean when we say Malkeinu, right? And if that's true, it's very obvious of a king. Perhaps it's a little less obvious, but should be presented as well, that Avinu, a father today, is not necessarily what a father was back then either, both pro and con. But simply it's a different role. I mean, again, just like we spoke about African witch doctors also being doctors, alongside the heart surgeon. Here too, yes, there are fathers and fathers. If father is just a question of procreating a child, well, yeah, then they're all fathers. But is that really what Chazal had in mind when they spoke about Avinu, simply someone who brought us to life, perhaps? But more likely, there was much more depth to the metaphor than simply someone that brought us into life. Otherwise, Boreinu is fine. Boreinu is just as good if it's only that dimension, I would imagine, and I would suggest. One of the other issues is that the spiritual reality being described is more remote to us as well. Again, this is part and parcel of modernity. This is part and parcel of, we spoke about in the previous class, of galut, of lack of prophecy. So spiritual reality is something that's much more distant to us, certainly from a historical plane and for many other reasons as well. It's not part of common parlance in Western society. I mean, God is, but God, again, is something that's very widely described, or very widely defined, rather. And certainly when we speak about Olam Haba, while in religious circles it's something that still has a lot of currency, certainly it's not something that's discussed very frequently in your average sitcom in the United States or in Europe or what have you. As a result, these concepts that are supposed to be clarified through the mashal are even further away to begin with. So the mashal has to be even more powerful because the concept is further away. But in fact, the word that's being used as the mashal, the comparing word, like the broken heart, it itself is weaker. So you have a double whammy. And if that weren't bad enough, there's a third issue, which I think is also related to modernity, even though you find it in the least modern circles. And that's the confusion between the mashal and the nimshal. Meaning that when God is described as king, it was meant to be something to help us understand what he is. Right? At no point was it seriously entertained that he is a king, or that he's a father. He has properties, physical properties of a father. My point being that in some circles there is a literal understanding of things that are clearly meant to be mashal, right? Meaning that they're meant to be a device and not a description of the reality itself. And this is extremely problematic on a theological level. When you speak about God as having certain characteristics, the characteristics being things that were meant to be mashalim and not essentially describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And by the way, this is an issue with the popularization of Kabbalah as well, in the sense that Kabbalah is a world like other areas of Agarata that is replete with mashalim. And there's a great danger in teaching Kabbalah to the masses when the mashal replaces the nimshal. When we think of God as something that's personified in this body with the sefirot become God. And this was part of the challenge originally made by anti-Kabbalah forces in the rabbinic world when Kabbalah first became popular, first in Spain, but more readily in the time of the Ari. And his students. You know, it's interesting that modern man's refusal to understand the function of mashal in the spiritual realm somewhat echoes that of a child. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many of you have children that are grown up enough to ask this question, but quite often when you tell a story, the child asks, "Did it really happen?" Right, so when and same is true when you speak about a mashal in Chazal. Mashal is often a story, you know, about a king and a son, or Moshe Rabbeinu or whoever it is, and the child will ask, "Did it really happen?" So for a child, it makes sense to ask such a question because there's a leap between the mashal and the nimshal. Unfortunately, in our own times, there is an estrangement from the nimshal, which makes people want to glom on to the mashal. So much so that modern men also ask about God, you know, is it real? Where the point of the mashal is not the reality, but rather the explanatory value of the mashal. And it's interesting that in speech, you know, we use metaphors like brokenhearted freely, but religious metaphors have broken down where there is a sort of unwillingness to make the leap between the mashal and the nimshal as if there could be anything beyond the figure of speech. But let's go back to the original issue, at least the example that I want to speak to you about, and that's description of Olam Haba. So what sort of mashalim do we see about Olam Haba? Anybody want to throw anything out?
Shabbat.
Okay, so Shabbat is Me'ein Olam Haba, yeah.
Are you talking about Olam Haba or Olam HaNeshamot?
Yeah, let's call Olam HaNeshamot.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, again, linguistic mashalim, there don't have to be a whole story. I'm not looking for stories per se.
Prozdor,
Like a prosdor. Prosdor
or prosdor with treklin.
The treklin. Okay, so in other words, the olam haba would be the treklin, right? Treklin is banquet hall.
The hall, as opposed to the entranceway.
Okay, the hall, presumably it's a fancy, right? It's not just a, you know, a hallway in between classrooms, right? Right, good. Olam haba itself, in itself, is a metaphor. Very good. Right. So let's just start with Shabbat as being me'in olam haba. So is Shabbat today the same as Shabbat was when the term was coined? And my answer is clearly not. It's clearly not the same. Again, is there a common basis? Is there a common basis between a witch doctrine and a surgeon? There is. Okay? And I will grant you that I hope our Shabbat is closer to the traditional Shabbat than the difference between a witch doctor and a surgeon. But there are important differences. I'll point one out to you that I heard that was brought to my attention by Raviol Ben Nun, who is primarily a Mikra person, someone who is very involved in the study of Tanakh. Was quite familiar with study of ancient civilizations as well. And he points out something which is reflected as late as the tefillah that we say in Kabbalat Shabbat. What we're speaking about was that in the ancient world, the number of seven had very scary connotations as an end point. There was a certain awe and perhaps even trepidation that accompanied the seventh day. And he says, if you look at the composition, which mizmorim were chosen in the Kabbalat Shabbat service as a product of the Kabbalist, of the students of the RE, that's 500 years ago, it's not so long ago, but if you look at them, they're not the happiest. You know, we sing with the Shlomo Kalva Nigunim, but if you look at the mizmorim, the Tehillim, many of them are very awesome, awe-inspiring, and even, again, a little bit inviting of trepidation. So there's a certain characteristic of Shabbat, the awe and trepidation that no longer exists in our observance of Shabbat. Even if we observe the same Isurei Malachot, even if we make the same Kiddush, the tone is very different. And tone is very important. Not saying we've lost Shabbat, Chas v'Shalom. Again, Shabbat is metamorphosized. But that means that when the term was coined, that Olam Haba is me'ein, is like Olam Haba, one has to wonder, well, what was meant by that? So usually you'll hear, well, same pleasure you have on Shabbat by eating and drinking and so on and so forth, that's what you're going to have in Olam Haba. But is that really the only dimension? If that's the only dimension of the way we experience Shabbat, and may be, and may legitimately be the case, we still may be misunderstanding the mashal of Me'ein Olam Ba for Shabbat. In any case, that's one thing. The other point that was mentioned before, the whole concept of Olam, today, when you think of an olam, we can envision that in much more physical terms. You know, there's, again, olamot. We know we speak about spiritual worlds, but today, the very word olam is much more physically conceived in our own mind, which, again, makes it more difficult to appreciate what it is that Chazal, in this case, put together with this term, Olam Haba, right? We're trying to get across. And again, this is obviously compounded by the fact that we as modern Westerns have difficulty with any spiritual phenomena. And therefore, as I said before, the concept is further away, which would require us to have a stronger metaphor to help us understand what's more elusive, where in fact the metaphors of old, while we'll explain in a minute, may still be useful, are weaker than they once were. In truth, I should point out that this is not a problem for everyone. I imagine it's a problem for many of us here. It's not a problem for anyone because the issue is not one of reality. It's not one of understanding Olam Haba, because ultimately no one, before they get there, understands Olam Haba, again, Olam HaNeshamot, for simplicity's sake. The question is sufficient language to appreciate the idea enough to motivate us in our religious behavior. Now, for some people, it's simply enough to know, you know, I'm going to get a reward from God, and it's going to be great, and therefore I can move on. A certain class of people that don't think about what this reward is supposed to be about, at least on a conscious level. And there's another group of people who form the upper echelons, traditionally form the upper echelons of the Jewish people, and that is the group that needs no motivatory scheme to do what God wants. Right? The lishmars, people who are working on a level of lishma, the great Jewish thinkers, the great Kabbalists, no doubt, were operating on this level, and therefore, even if were they not to have sufficient language to understand what they realized could not be understood, didn't bother them. The problem is a growing intellectual middle class. Right? In the past, there were Talmidei Chachamim, who were serious people who were able to rise to the task, and there were Amei Haaretz who didn't care much, were able to accept things on a simple level, perhaps were somewhat less motivated in some cases, but still were able to move on a very simplistic basis. One of the mixed blessings of modernity is mass education, where we know enough to get ourselves into trouble, but not enough to get ourselves out of it. And so we have this entire group of people that, again, I think most of us are a part of, that is thirsty for some sort of understanding because they're not on the level where they can go beyond their own self-interest to simply do what God wants for its own sake. And therefore, the need for appropriate language to express that is compounded. And I would say that this has not a small role in the defection of many Jews. Perhaps not now, although I think it's true now as well, but certainly during the time of the Enlightenment and emancipation, especially in Eastern Europe, I don't know how many narratives we've read about where the person expects that the first time they were to eat something not kosher or to break Shabbat, that they would be hit by a bolt of lightning. And when they weren't, then they continued to act in such a way because they realized the metaphor wasn't true. But again, the metaphor was true, they simply didn't understand the metaphor. And that's because there's this new class that seeks to understand the metaphor, even as the metaphor becomes, in modern times, less and less accessible. Now, what do we do about this problem? And obviously, it's a discussion that needs a lot of time, and I'm only presenting one example of an issue that has, as I said at the beginning, all sorts of ramifications and all sorts of spheres. I mentioned three issues. I mentioned three problems. Number one, I'll start with the easiest, go to what's perhaps the hardest, and then the one we can do something about. The easiest is confusion of mashal and nimshal. That, I think, is simply a question of education, of allowing people to realize the nature of metaphor, that metaphor is meant not to describe reality per se, but to explain a deeper level of understanding. Again, that will have different applications in different situations, but ultimately that's a fairly easy issue to unravel. The second issue, which I mentioned, I think we'll leave for Rabbi Cardozo, and that's to try to understand the phenomena themselves, to try to understand God. Obviously, the further God is, the further their spirituality is, the harder it is to describe with mashalim. And again, this is something that requires experts and requires a lot of heavy work and may not be something that we as educators may have much of a role in. But the third issue, and perhaps the most important issue, is the tools at our command. In other words, language that we use as tools in the classroom and on some level, also in the liturgy. In other words, liturgy is not frozen. Granted, it's difficult to make major changes, but there's room for change in liturgy as well. I remember Rabbi Cardoza and I were speaking after Rosh Hashanah and wondering, you know, if there's something more productive we can do than the endless repetition of the same words on Yom Kippur. I mean, there's a lot of phrases that are repeated over and over again, but a lot of things that are very distant to us. So when I speak about education, I'm speaking about in the classroom, and I'm speaking about outside the classroom, in the shul, and in the lecture hall as well. There are all sorts of places where we can address the issue. Again, the issue that we can address is proper understanding and an analysis of language, and that has two ramifications. Number one, to analyze the mashalim that we do have in our tradition. In other words, we can't simply mouth words that we don't understand any more than we can mouth Chinese and expect to have some sort of impact. But in any case, to mouth words that are incomprehensible to us is not very helpful. Therefore, on the first level, we have to simply look at the tradition's words and make sure that we understand them, double check that we understand them. The example that I gave before of Avinu Malkeinu, so if we don't have immediate access to all-powerful, often arbitrary kings in our own days, and perhaps there are some dictators like that, but they're fewer and further between to find. But presumably, you know, part of the definition of the king that we are looking at is this absolute arbitrary power. And it's important to clarify that to our students. That Avinu Malkeinu is not just a person who sits on a throne with a crown, has a lot of money and servants, but rather the central, or certainly one of the central themes implied in the Mashal, is the sense of absolute power. This ability to do anything he wants with us at any time. That's number one. The question is, what is the act of malchut? What is it to be molech? Right? So I would suggest that there also, the sense is to act with complete and absolute power.
Doing whatever he wants.
Yeah, so there also, if you look in the history of kings, I mean, especially the end of the power of the English throne, there's a lot of discussion of to what extent does a king have really absolute power. So you're right, there is some restraint as well, but the restraint is so much less than anything we know of today. There is the sense that the king's having a bad day, you know, regardless of the restraints that constitutionally are imposed from above, from below, or from his own conscience, you know, he can still send the person to death if he has a bad day. No one's going to stop him. Yeah, it may have ramifications on him, etc. I'm suggesting, given that certain mashalim are very entrenched in our tradition, such as Avinu Malkeinu, right, to try to uproot them completely is difficult and perhaps problematic as well. And even if we wanted to, it's not all clear that we could. I think pragmatically, we have to realize that we're not going to be able to get rid of many mashalim. So we have to do both these things. Number one, I think we do have to understand better the mashalim that exist, because they're there. We have to understand what were Chazal trying to convey, and especially if there are things that we want to or need to say, such as Avinu Malkeinu. The other suggestion, which is the next point, is that we do have to look for new metaphors. As things that are foreign, such as kings, fall away, we've seen that the concept of metaphors is tremendously valuable in education in general, and in spiritual education in particular. And therefore, there is all to be gained by trying to come up with new mashalim, not necessarily to replace, but at least to augment the old mashalim that do exist. We know that Chazal gave us the tradition of using metaphors and storytelling and the like, and that tradition has carried on to our own day. What I think needs to be done is to create certain central metaphors, in the sense that Avinu Malkeinu is a central metaphor of the Jewish people with tremendous power that was able to, you know, help the Jewish people understand in all of its breadth a certain dimension of Kadosh Baruch Hu that proved to be very productive throughout history. Previous class we were speaking about a baseball game, right? So that's a very nice informal metaphor, but I'm not sure it has the wherewithal to create the necessary explanatory role that earlier metaphors had played. And I'm suggesting that there's a need for such central, powerful metaphors. Obviously, there's a big problem, and it's not so simple to offhandedly, in the middle of a drasha or discussion, speak about a baseball game is fine and dandy. But if you're talking about these types of central historical metaphors, it's a much more involved process. But I think this relates to something that has been a theme through many of my talks, and I think other talks that we have in the school as well, and that is the sense that there's some serious historical challenges facing traditional Judaism, and there needs to be concerted effort to address these issues. And here, perhaps the nature of the threat is much more elusive. It's not something that's readily available. The fact that we don't have mashalim available, people will say, okay, so what's the big deal? No one's not becoming from as a result. So, first of all, I'm not sure. I indicated before, I'm not sure that that's correct at all. But secondly, if you think about it, one realizes that the transformation of language has a very important effect on how we act as Jews, and specifically in our spiritual lives. Therefore, I think that there is a need for not just informal metaphors as they come to the speaker, but some sort of a body could be convened, but simply all the best minds that can apply themselves to such a thing should apply themselves to such a project. Okay.
If I say metaphor, even if you say metaphor, Rav Avinash is a metaphor.
Okay.
Say it. Rav Sharma is a metaphor.
Right. Okay. So for us, as with most of our discussion, there's two levels. So in the classroom, you know, you certainly have to explain what Malkeinu means. That's the bottom line for everyone. And again, I use that as an example. I hope it's clear that when I say that, you should explain what Shabbat means in the metaphor of Man Olam Haba. These are just examples out of many, but at the same time, anybody who's going to be involved in creative work, be it in the modest confines of your classroom, and creative work, I mean in terms of developing central metaphors, among other things, should keep this historical perspective in mind. Whether you're confined, again, to the modesty of your classroom, or whether you become a great thinker and a leader of the Jewish people. You never know where an idea is going to come from. And the more people that are working on it, even on a modest scale, the more likely it is that, if not our ideas, other people's ideas will come to the fore. Again, I think there's certain central concepts that exist in our society. I would throw one out, and I don't, you know, just to throw it, to give you an example, whether it's a good metaphor or whether it's similar to the Queen of England, you know, you can decide yourself. The concept of machinery, right, as a metaphor for God. I mean, the clockmaker has been used in the past, and we don't mean that, but computers have been suggested, machinery, these are universal terms. And again, there's pros and cons. Obviously, there are things where we see that this would help us in our understanding of God's power, of his greatness in doing things that are way beyond human abilities. At the same time, there's obvious problems with implying any sort of mechanistic reaction from God, even though there are reasons to say that such would not necessarily be completely incorrect. I really don't have any extra time, but I just want to conclude with perhaps one final thought, and that is the following. I presented a challenge to you, and I've presented something that maybe we weren't aware of. And again, it's funny, those of you who were at Rabbi Helfgott's talk on Shabbat, you know, he presented ideas comparing Bereishit and Shemot, which were, once you see them, so obvious. And I was speaking to Rabbi Grummet about it later, and I said, you know, it's the same reaction that people had to things that I said in my own book, that once you see it, you wonder why you didn't see it before. The issue that I'm presenting about development, I mean, again, going back to the previous semester, development of history has all sorts of ramifications, both in realia and today. Another area that I'm glad that Rabbi Cardoza gave me the opportunity to speak about is the development of language. It presents an awareness that turns into a challenge, both as educators and as serious Jews, something that we need to be aware about. I presented two specific drachim that need to be addressed and a couple more less directly. But I want to conclude with one last thought, and this is a thought that relates back also to the political discussion. I think it's an issue that weaves through a lot of my thought right now in terms of what modernity, in the direction that modernity is forcing us to go to. And that is that this metaphor crisis, if you want to call it that, probably the first one and only one we'll ever call it that, but this metaphor crisis pushes us, at least in the specific area that I spoke about, religious motivation, into an area that we should want to go with into anyways. In other words, we can try to bridge the metaphor gap, but it's not clear that we're going to be successful. I think we have to try nonetheless. But especially if we're not successful, that means that we have to push ourselves to be motivated, perhaps, for altruistic reasons. In other words, we're in a situation for many reasons that we have to serve God, to do mitzvot, lishma, and not for egotistical reasons, even though that is how we're made up, and Chazal understood that, and realized that, and worked with that. As a lot of the motivatory schemes, both from the outside, like we spoke about at the beginning of the religious coercion, and from the inside, education, the tools of education, right, linguistic tools, break down. So as these various motivatory schemes break down, that creates more and more of a pressure on us to understand the beauty of what we're doing and want to do it for its own sake. Again, an agenda to eliminate this metaphor is not what this is about, because it's not realistic, and I'm not sure it's desirable. So since it's not realistic, I don't even have to explore the possibility of whether it's desirable or not. People are going to make mistakes, but I think as most historical developments, the mistakes are washed away by history. Bad things don't stick around. That means that we should try to come up with good things, and if we fail, we don't need to worry. History will take care of whatever mistakes we make.